and it he's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for a
good day. This is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is part of our series on veterans. And today we are interviewing Joseph R. Ulatowski. And this is our third or fourth interview with him. Joe is an interesting guy. He was born in Stanford, Connecticut, beautiful downtown Stanford, home of the Stars, and enlisted in the Army when he was 17 years old. And he was in the service for 32 and a half years and retired as a brigadier general. And I've gotten to know Joe over these past few interviews, and he is a veteran that I have a great deal of respect for, and he has a story that we all need to hear. And one of the things that I'm going to introduce Joe here in a minute, I'm just blabbing, but one of the things that Joe said to me that stuck with me, that he said one of the greatest rewards of life, or things that he remembers in life that was so important to him, was to be able to command veterans that were in the infantry and to work with those veterans who gave so much for this country. So today we're going to be talking about the third time that Joe was in Vietnam, his third tour in Vietnam. So, Joe, is there anything else, any other wonderful things I should say about you, or if
I think you've already said too much.
All right, yeah, probably true. So let's talk about that third time that you were in Vietnam. Prior to that, you were in the United States for a while. Where were you just prior to going back to Vietnam for your third time?
I was the military assistant to the Undersecretary of the Army in the Pentagon.
Okay.
And I had written any number of letters to various commanders in Vietnam requesting a brigade assignment, and they all turned me down. They had their own people that they knew that they wanted to put in positions. And apparently something happened within the 25th Division where a brigade opened up, and one Monday morning, I got a phone call saying if I could be there the following Friday, I could get the brigade. So I went in to ask the undersecretary to be relieved from my job as the military assistant. And his first question, he looked at me and said, "Have you asked your wife yet?" And I said, "No, I can't ask or tell her until you tell me you'll relieve me." So he finally did, and I called Edie, and she asked me whether I was going to come home or pack or not. And I was off. I didn't make it on Friday. I made it on Sunday.
Wow.
And the brigade was in Cambodia at the time. So I took it over there, relieved the person who was in temporary command, and I had a brigade in the 25th Division.
Wow. That was kind of a quick...
Quick transition. But everything that you did before that prepared you for the job.
Right. And I think it's important, too, that even though you were high up in the Pentagon, they knew who really ruled the roost. Got to check with the wife first before you go anyplace. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, I remember. And I remember having a being offered a job, a very good job, in Fairbanks, Alaska. And my wife, when I told her that, she said, "Enjoy yourself." And so I chose not to take that job. So. what happened? You went to Cambodia, and things must have been pretty fast and furious at that point.
Oh, yeah, they were. And then I took it out, and we took a breather, and they sent me off on a separate mission and sent the brigade off on a separate mission. It was the 2nd Brigade of the 25th Division then, about 4,000 men. And so I was separate from the division, operating together with the local Vietnamese forces, the local Vietnamese armed forces, and with the Australian brigade that was there, and with the Thai division that was there. And so we had a very close relationship in cooperation with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to the east of Saigon, and I forget at this point, but was either War Zone C or D, is what was known. And so we just maintained constant pressure. We located the brigade headquarters across the main transit route for resupply from the north to the south, to the southern part of Vietnam. And spent the next, 4 or 5 months there. And then this was during the drawdown.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, kind of at that time.
Yeah.
That's when there was quite a bit of unrest in the United States, lots of demonstrations politically. Johnson was saying to draw down. Was it Johnson or Nixon that was?
I think it was Nixon.
Yeah.
Nixon, Kissinger.
Right.
And it was purely a political negotiations were going on in Paris and all of that.
Right.
There were agreements being made that I got to witness later.
Right.
As I went back for my fourth tour.
Right.
But so it was not any heavy fighting going on. It was just constant pressure, keeping the troops in the field, understanding the trauma that in many cases they were going through because of, well, who wants to be the last man shot? When you know that sooner or later you're going to be getting out of there.
Right.
So you had to be, you had that conflict in your mind all the way. Is this operation necessary? Have you done everything possible to protect them? Have you told them what you're doing? You had to keep them advised because, you know, when you're talking at a higher level, you always are, you never know whether what you say and what you feel gets down to the people at the lower level.
Right. And I would imagine also at that time, even among the troops, it must have been a lot of rumors going around what should we do? What shouldn't we do?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And so your job was to try to be as transparent as possible and let troops know what was going on.
Well, I always tried to do that anyway, because informed people will always respond better than some people who are trying to guess what's going on. And it's hard enough to convey it down through the chain to get to the troops.
And what was there, with your brigade there, were they engaging with the enemy at that time?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the things that makes you so very proud, because under those circumstances, they did their job. They did their job, and they did it superbly.
Yeah.
And then about, after 6 months of command, they were going to rotate me out and send me over to be an advisor to the 18th Vietnamese Division. And they decided to pull the decision in Washington, decided was that the 25th Division would be leaving, but they would leave behind a separate brigade to function. And they selected me to be the commander of the separate brigade, and I built it, structured it, and for the next 6 months, I had a mini division of about 7,000 people.
Wow.
And an expanded area of operation and much more integration with the Australian and the Thai forces that were there.
Was the mission also to get the South Vietnamese army to kind of take over all the functions of United States so that United States could leave? Was that also a charge that you had?
No, it wasn't. That was handled differently than through me. My mission with the brigade was strictly keep the pressure on throughout the entire area, and wherever, and sometimes outside of my own area, where they needed some more pressure, I would send a battalion out there to work in whatever that job was. But we were on the go all the time.
Did you put a lot, was that a thing where you put a lot of pressure on the Ho Chi Minh Trail too at that point, or to try
and... No. I was on the other side of Vietnam, on the other side of Saigon from the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Okay. And so I would imagine just the pressure that you were putting on was really to almost to further negotiations, to keep the pressure on them.
I imagine that was the view from the top. But as far as I was concerned, I just had a piece of property out there, and my mission was to keep the pressure on. Mm-hmm. And I didn't worry about what was going on in other places in Vietnam. I mean, it was sort of a peripheral interest.
Right.
But it's with 7,000 people, you focus on how do you use them best. And I have to point out, this was the period of time when the use of narcotics and the so-called black problem was there, where there was friction between, not in the combat forces, but in the rear areas, between the blacks and the establishment. And so it wasn't that it didn't bother the combat units that much. That was in the background, but it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And in the combat units, the troops pretty well policed themselves.
Right. And that's kind of what I've heard from other veterans, is that while there was always some issues of race, that when you're out in the field and you have an assignment to do, you have to trust the people you're with.
Right.
You know, your life is in their hands.
Absolutely.
And so when someone is protecting you, you could care less if they're black or white or Hispanic or or whatever.
And you can't, to be perfectly honest, you can't do that much about it.
Right.
I mean, people are going to be people. They're going to get along with people or they're not. Some of the stories I've heard about the combat units there from the people, they told each other, if you're high when you go out, my first bullet might be toward the enemy.
Yeah.
And
the second bullet is towards you if you're not protecting us. Yeah. Interesting you said that, because we interviewed one gentleman who was kind of in Vietnam at that time, and he got off of drugs after he came back to the United States, but he said many times he went out on missions where he was high and was not thinking clearly, and he felt guilty that people may have been injured or killed because he was not able to do his job correctly. And I think that's something that, you know, he had to live with, and came back and caused him problems here.
Mm-hmm.
Mental health issues and PTSD and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And he was, again, one of those persons who said that downtime, you know, what did, you know, like you mentioned, people didn't know if they were going to be leaving Vietnam in a week or 2 weeks or complete their entire tour of duty. And their purpose was to stay alive at that time. And that had to be a main focus for many of them.
Well, that was a main focus, and it was a main focus on us too, as their commanders, because we had to face that exact same question: have I done everything that I can to ensure your survivability and going home?
Yeah.
Thinking about, you know, a number of things that we tried to do. One of the biggest things was the information. Everybody that came in, we continued to get a flow of recruits at that period of time. It wasn't stable. Those who served their year or whatever period of time they were serving rotated through. We got recruits, but every recruit that came in had to go through a orientation phase. We had our own little school for the new people who came in. And one of the things we tried to portray was, during this period of time, you are going to be out in the field. You come out of the field back, and I'm synthesizing this a little bit. You come out of the field, you're drinking your beer, you're getting showers, and everything is, the pressure is now off, the pressure of the field patrolling and all of this, or field operation. And while all of this is going on, you suddenly get a call, and you're told, grab your rucksack, grab your weapon, and form up. We'll be out there. Helicopters should be in to pick you up. And there you sit. No helicopters come in. Nothing happens. Well, let me tell you what's going through my, and the reason I said you should do this. And that is, you got a bunch of guys in another unit that's out on patrol, and they're in deep stuff.
Do-do, yes.
And so the minute they get in that stuff, the local commanders immediately try and reinforce them, and they report it up to me. And I'm thinking ahead, what happens if the local resources, the unit down there, the battalion, doesn't have enough troops? I want to make sure that I am ready to throw in whatever I possibly can to get you out of trouble. Mm-hmm. Now, how would you feel if you were out there in the field just saying, those guys up there don't give a damn about me? Just remember, I'm always thinking, as the commander, I'm always thinking, what if? What can I do if those guys out there need help? And how would you feel if I didn't do that?
Right.
So that was sort of the...
And sure, they're thinking also, if they're out in the field, they're also thinking of those guys that are having the beer and getting the shower, and they would rather be there. And so you need to really reinforce that these people are ready to go and they're going to...
Oh, absolutely.
You, yeah.
You always have to get them ready. But the guy, and sometimes the guy who's getting the beer and the shower says, sitting out there waiting for helicopters come in, not knowing exactly what's going to happen, damn, those guys up there, they're screwing around with us again.
Yeah, yeah. One question I wanted to ask you, and I think this really applies, and I've heard this from several veterans, is that there was every kind of job in Vietnam that you would find in a city in United States. I mean, there were millions of different kinds of jobs. At one time, somebody said that for every person, every infantryman or woman that was out in the field, there were 24 other people supporting them in some other manner. And the statement was, there were no unimportant jobs in Vietnam, that the guy that was doing the clerical work, the person that was repairing helicopters, the person that was cooking, every job was as important as the person that was out in the field. Is that a fair statement, that every single one of those jobs was supportive of each other?
Well, that's a true statement. To a certain extent. I don't know about the figures of 24 or
sure,
what.
Sure.
That's for numbers people.
Yeah, that's right.
But basically, it is disproportionate. If you would look at any military operation, when it goes in there, the tip of the sword or the tip of the spear or the whatever you want to call it,
people on the front line.
The people on the front lines are really nowhere near as numerous as all of the backup and all of those other jobs. And, of course, that's where you have a lot of problems, because a lot of those jobs have to be done, but there's also, they're not 100% busy. The guy in the field always has his mind working. What am I going to do? When am I going to be in danger? The guy in back, when he doesn't have something to do, his off hours, his off time, doesn't have anything to do.
Right.
Or, well, he has to make up something. And with red-blooded young Americans,
right
there.
One of the sites that I see, it's pictures of Vietnam veterans have sent back, and it's during monsoon season, and it's showing a guy kind of with a squeegee, kind of a broom, squeegee broom, pushing mud out in front of a hooch. And it says, the caption underneath it, it says, never tell your officer that you don't have anything to do, because we'll find something for you to do. And I think that's with my brother-in-law. I think that was one of his issues, was that it was kind of feast or famine.
Yeah.
They were either just, you know, he said they would work sometimes, you know, 12, 14, 16 hours at a time, and then get 6 hours of sleep, get up, ready to do it again, and there was nothing to do, or there was no, you know, assignment.
Yeah, and this you have to look at is, when you're a military planner, you don't know precisely what you're planning for or what you are going to need. And this is where things come in. You start saying, I need so many men to do this task. And you get them there, and there's no task.
Yeah.
Or it's not quite the task of the magnitude that you need all of this force for.
Right.
And so there you are, and you start cutting down back ways and all of that. But for the people who are there, they are just, they're there.
Wow. Well, that's really, I think that's really important information. And I think that really gives us a good way to break here. And let's go into, we're going to talk the next time about the time when you, the next tour, when you came back into Vietnam. So right now, we're going to close it up for this session. And thank you very much for listening. And we'll be back with Joe Ulatowski in the next episode.
He's 5 foot two, and he's 6 feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31, and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.